So the final paper on iron status related to cognitive performance, I think I need some iron, is in the elderly in Chianti population. Okay. Is being presented by Lanice Chen. And Lanice is from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Hi, thank you for the introduction and good afternoon. I'm pleased to be able to present on iron status and its relation to cognitive performance in the elderly in Chianti population. I have no relationships to disclose. So to give you a bit of information about the importance of iron deficiency and the importance of cognition, we would want to start with the definition of anemia. So anemia is difficulty carrying oxygen to parts of the body. It affects about a quarter of the world's population, and prevalences in the elderly in particular can vary widely, but up to 61% in men and up to 41% in women. So it can be quite prevalent in the elderly as well. Iron deficiency is, in particular, the most common nutritional deficiency in the world and accounts for about half of the anemia that we see. Additionally, iron deficiency in the elderly is a common cause of anemia. And dementias are among the top 20 leading causes of global burden of disease. They also rank among the sixth leading cause of disability in females worldwide.
Use a specific number for hemoglobin cutoff?
Oh, we did, yes.
What was that?
12 for males and, I'm sorry, 12 for females and 13 for, 13 for males and 12 for females. So in terms of iron status and cognition, an inconsistent relation exists in the literature. So a positive correlation was found in an Italian study between cognition and iron. In a subsequent study, iron status was found to be significantly lower in dementia patients, and in iron deficient patients, cognitive scores were found to be significantly lower. In a study called the Rancho Bernardo study, which you may have heard of elderly individuals, they found interactions or effect modification by sex. So males who were iron deficient or who had iron overload actually had poorer cognitive scores, so it was a U-shaped relation. However, for females, they found an inverse linear relation between iron and cognition. And then finally, a recent study by Millward et al. Found no relation between iron and cognitive measures, so there have been some inconsistencies. So to further our studies and our contribution to the literature, our aim was to investigate at baseline the influence of iron status using multiple iron and complete blood count measures on cognitive performance in the elderly in Chianti population. Our sample comes from in Chianti. It's the Aging in Chianti study in Italy. It's a prospective population-based study of mobility in Italian elderly. And the sample had 1,043 subjects at least 65 years of age. Measures included iron measures. These included a complete blood count, including hemoglobin, which is a measure of oxygen in the blood, oxygen carrying in the blood, ferritin, which is a measure of iron stores, transferrin receptor, which is a measure of the receptor that holds on to the transport molecule for iron, and serum iron. And in terms of cognitive measures, we measured a global test of cognitive function called the Mini Mental State Examination Test, as well as the Trail Making Test Parts A and B. The TMTA is considered a test of processing speed, while the TMTB is considered a test of executive function. In terms of iron and its relation to cognition, we wanted to characterize and categorize iron properly. And in order to do so, we wanted to consider features of our population. The first was that it's an aging population. So we wanted to consider age. The second is that aging populations tend to have a lot of inflammation. So we wanted to consider that inflammation status in our iron characterization. So the first thing we did was adjust iron values based on inflammation status, and these used methods according to recent literature that did so. And then the second thing we did was we applied ferritin cutoffs that were appropriate to older populations, and this was also based on literature that supported a higher ferritin cutoff for older individuals as compared to younger adults. So we categorized individuals into four different categories: iron deficiency anemia, iron deficiency without anemia, iron sufficiency, and iron overload. And as we mentioned just now with the hemoglobin, we use standard cutoffs for hemoglobin for anemia and standard cutoffs for ferritin for iron overload. And for iron deficiency, we designated that as two or more abnormal measures of iron. One of those abnormal measures had to be either ferritin, which is the iron stores, or transferrin receptor. In order to look at iron and cognition, we wanted to compare. There are different ways that we wanted to do that. So the first way was to compare iron categories and the values between iron categories, and we used a Bonferroni correction to account for multiple comparisons. The second way that we looked at iron and cognition is we used multiple linear regressions of MMSE, or mini mental state examination on iron status, and we used three different models that controlled for a variety of covariates. The first model controlled for demographic variables, smoking and alcohol covariates. The second model additionally controlled for B vitamins and omega-3 status. And the third model controlled for all of those covariates, as well as depressive symptoms and selected medical variables. We also did regressions with the trail making test as outcomes, and the TMTB as an outcome controlled for TMTA status, in addition to all the covariates that I mentioned. So these next two slides are going to be demographic and health status variables, all of which were controlled for in the various multilinear regression models. So just to give you an example of the population, it was more female than male. It was pretty evenly split between the two areas in Italy, and the vast majority of individuals were either married or widowed. As expected, there were younger individuals. There are more individuals in the 65 to 74 range, for example, than the oldest old. And this was a very limited education sample. So as you can see, almost three quarters of the sample only had an education level of 5 years or less. In terms of health status, about 40% of individuals were either former or current smokers. More than half were either non-alcoholic drinkers, or they only drank about one drink per day, but more than 10% drank four drinks per day. At least one chronic disease was present in almost 64% of the sample. Hypertension was present in about half, and metabolic syndrome was present in almost a quarter of the sample. So this slide is to show you that hematology values differ significantly by iron status. So the first row indicates the different categories of iron. You'll notice that we had 42 individuals who were classified as iron deficient anemic, 55 who were classified as iron deficient, 326 as iron sufficient, and 161 were placed into the iron overload category. Now, we did use a very strict categorization, so not all individuals were placed into these categories. There was also an uncategorizable category. And in the left column are a variety of hematology measures. And it's not important that you know what all of the abbreviations are for all the different measures. For example, ferritin is FT. But the main point is that these are all iron-related measures. And the important point, these are median values in 25th and 75th percentile. And the main point is that these highlighted values are significantly different from iron-sufficient values. And these dark values, the bolded ones, are significantly different between iron deficient anemic and iron deficient. And we expected this based on the way that we categorized the individuals into the different iron categories. So now we see our cognitive scores by iron status. And you can see that iron deficient anemic and iron deficient individuals had significantly lower mini mental state examination scores compared to iron sufficient individuals. You'll also see that trail making test A scores were significantly higher. They spent more time doing the TMTA compared to iron sufficient individuals. So these were worse scores in the iron deficient anemic. And similarly, with the trail making test B, these scores were worse in the iron deficient anemic and iron deficient individuals compared to the iron sufficient individuals. In terms of regression analyses, you'll see the three different models controlling for the different covariates. And the cognitive outcomes of mini mental state examination and trail making test A on the left, Trail making test B is not included because we did not see any significant results in the regression analyses for TMTB. But again, with the highlighted, you'll see this is p-value of less than 0.05, that iron-deficient anemic individuals had on average 1.8 points of a lower score on the MMSE compared to iron-sufficient individuals in both models 1 and 2. And then in model 1, iron-deficient individuals scored almost, on average, 21 seconds slower on the TMTA compared to iron-sufficient individuals. So in summary, evidence suggests that individuals with poorer iron status performed worse on cognitive tests, especially the mini mental state examination. And in terms of contributions to the literature, what our study adds is we look comprehensively at multiple iron measures. A lot of studies look at single iron measures, like just ferritin or just transferrin, but we looked at a composite of a lot of different measures and applied strict criteria for the classification of iron status. And Chianti also has a wealth of C-reactive protein data, so we were able to leverage that inflammation data to better characterize iron status in this sample. And we also considered the aging nature of this population when we categorized people into different iron categories. In terms of future directions, Inchianti is a prospective study. So although I'm presenting data at baseline, we're also planning to look at values longitudinally. So you'll see on the x-axis time, so there's baseline and 3, 6, and 9 years of follow-up for the Inchianti study. And the trail making TMTP on the y-axis. And you'll see that iron-deficient anemic and iron-deficient individuals in the orange and the green have higher or worse TMTP scores over time compared to iron-sufficient and iron-overload individuals in the blue and yellow, respectively. So this is kind of a future direction for our research. So just in terms of public health implications, there is a link between cognition and mental or physical outcomes. So hopefully we have shown some relation between iron and cognition. So there might also be a relation between iron and other mental and physical outcomes. Future studies of cognitive performance might want to consider iron status as a covariate. And this is important in terms of the measurement of iron status in individuals who are susceptible to cognitive decline. Most importantly, we hope that this research informs the prevention and treatment of elderly with poor iron status and also cognitive difficulties. And nutrition is great because it's a modifiable risk factor. So nutrition is something that we can hopefully change in individuals who are iron deficient, and we hope that we can modify cognition in that way. So these are my acknowledgments of my colleagues and funding sources. Thank you.
Our speakers, if you don't mind just standing up here, and we'll, I don't think we can really move very easily. And we would welcome questions to our speakers. Yeah.
Well, on the iron study, did you have some clues as to why certain individuals were iron deficient? Because it's not that common in elderly.
So in this particular,
a lot of iron overloaded people.
Right, we did have a lot of people with iron overload. So it's interesting because a lot of iron deficiency often is not because of intake by foods, but it's an absorption issue. So we haven't looked in particular at absorption issues in this sample, but my guess would be that part of it is because elderly individuals have problems with, sometimes they take a lot of antacids or things that inhibit absorption of iron. So that could be a possibility.
I think most of them community living elders, and I, but the, but long-term care facility also included. But because it's a national representative sample, and so very few live in the long-term care facilities, and especially, you know, most people, when they get old, the family take care of them, so very few go to the nursing home.
Okay. Other questions?
Yes. On the social isolation, now, yeah, I was surprised at how many individuals you said were eating alone, but were they possibly also living with their family, but they would eat by themselves? Or I expected in Taiwan, unlike in the U.S., where people kind of often choose to live by themselves, that usually the family system, if there's anybody around in the family, they usually take them in to live with them. So I was a little puzzled by the high incidence of elderly eating by themselves. Are they also living by themselves?
Yes, most of them. I think there's like 80-90%. Those who eat alone, they also live alone. And most of them males. And I think I speculate the reason is also because of the ethnicity. Mainlanders, when they came to Taiwan, they were young, but they couldn't get married because, you know, at that time there's some restriction. I don't quite understand. So most of them stay single for their lifetime. So when they get old, they still single.
Other questions? Well, I had a question for Dr. Haller. I was wondering, how did you end your study? Did you just like take away their cookies, or what happened? What are you doing from here on out? Or
yeah.
What are your
well? Just because this was the controlled study, we of course had to produce all the cookies at once, and. This was actually the condition of the Wisconsin Partnership Program initiative, that this had to be community, university, small business collaboration. So a small business in Wisconsin was producing the cookies. We did have to obviously make sure that when they were putting a certain amount of vitamin D in the cookie, that was actually the case. There was a very extensive analysis performed at the Dr. DeLucas laboratory at the University of Wisconsin to confirm the actual amount. Mm-hmm. And because the cookies were created specifically for the study, they're obviously not available easily after the study. But we also asked people, you know, they ate the cookies. Cookies had to be made at the same time, and the study lasted for 2 years, so you can imagine at the end of 2 years, what would be with the cookies. So people like to have the cookies, but they were complaining about the quality of chocolate.
Okay. So do you think there's any opportunity from a small business standpoint of producing this kind of
right?
This
company has been in business, and they're doing, but I don't think that they're using the same high levels of vitamin D in their cookies. Mm-hmm. And I know that nutritionally in the supplement and fortification, you have to go through a specific rules of how much you can actually mm-hmm. put in, and you can actually show that indeed, if you're claiming a certain amount of nutrients in the food, you really hope to have that. And there's no really the way to measure or to standardize mm-hmm. this at this point. So.
Well, I was just curious why go for fortified food rather than giving them the vitamin D?
The original reason for going with food was we did some investigation in the rural communities, and especially in some of the tribal communities, and people just really felt very uncomfortable with taking the pills. So we looked what would be the other way of deriving the vitamin D on the population level. So
I just had a follow-up question to that. Is preferable to have some other kind of food rather than cookies, counting the calories.
Well, this was a very low calorie, and this is a very, actually each cookie was about below 60 calories per cookie. So we had some concern using the cookie. It was for the company that was probably the easiest way to add vitamin D in food. And of course, I should acknowledge the fact that the University of Wisconsin in the 30s was the researchers from the university were the ones who came up with the method of adding vitamin D to various foods, specifically milk and others. But this was easier to quantify, measure, and control.
I have a question.
Yes, of course.
I mentioned about 7% who were on the supplement they were still under
39 grams per milliliter.
Right, so one of the factors related to not being able to absorb that, and is that related to the being in a cookie form, or is it related to other genetic or lifestyle factors?
It's a very good question. Actually, in my conclusions, I kind of slide over because of the time limitations. There's definitely some suggestion that the genetic component is a factor. The other issue is always an issue of measurement, what we measure. We're using 25-hydroxy-D as the measure of the vitamin D status. And that can we really hit the broad side of the barn kind of approach. If we go back when we were looking at the cholesterol status, and we were looking at the total cholesterol as the measure, and now we know that that's really not the way to talk about what your status is. You want to look at the LDH and the AGLs and so forth. And that's why we're also thinking that other metabolites of vitamin D are important, but our ability to measure it are just very limited. Even what kind of assay you are using, and clinically most of laboratories using the immune assay for measuring the vitamin D status, and you know it's really so inconsistent. We really have to do more in the science of vitamin D measurements.
Can I ask a follow-up? So is that related to why there's such a high prevalence of vitamin D deficiency across the board, across Americans? Or maybe, I don't know if it's in other populations, but a lot of people now, so is there a problem with the standards or the way we measure? It's highly prevalent in vitamin D deficiency.
All of the above.
Yeah. All right. We don't have an answer yet.
I think the Institutes of Health, when they did their studies, they used a cutoff of 20 rather than 30.
And that's for the skeletal status. And we still in the U.S. don't agree on what kind of assays to be used. The better type of surveys are chromatography-based surveys. So I guess the jury is still out there.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question regarding iron deficiency and the relationship of carrying the oxygen to the body parts. And did you think about, at that point, measuring also blood gases?
Like, for example?
In blood gases, it also gives you the measurement of how effective the red blood cells carry.
I guess we didn't think about that, and that's something to consider. One thing, though, is that we do specifically want to look at iron in particular, and there are many different causes of anemia, including macrocytic anemia, microcytic anemia. So we wanted to look and hone in on the iron piece of the anemia. And I guess one of my cautions I'm thinking of with just looking at gases is that might be too broad in terms of oxygen carrying in general and not iron specifically.
The gases are a lot of the pulmonary conditions that are going to give you low gases that won't be related to the iron.
Or a quick variable to use is the vital capacity. Just go in and do something. It gives you an idea of how well pulmonary function is.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I was interested in Ruthie's work, and I wondered whether or not others of you here are working in these community collaboratives where you're partnering different business entities, and I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about how this got started. How did you guys all decide this was such a great idea to do this, or, you know, forming that collaboration, and maybe anybody that's doing this kind of work could share what you guys are doing?
Sure. Well, I think we really got started based on, I'd say, lack of resources across, you know, in community public health initiatives in general. And so using GIS mapping to see what is going on in our specific community as it pertains to food insecurity, and then doing the same for aging populations, and just seeing that there are little niches and little pockets of efforts that really could be scaled throughout our county and throughout the community. And that there were also, you know, big areas not being identified, or, you know, someone talking about access to food assistance but nothing about nutrition and vice versa. So I think it came about through a state-funded grant that I was overseeing related to the Community Nutrition Action Plan, and then from there, you know, we're just in the, I'd say, second phase of, like, really rolling it out, and that's why we don't have the measurable outcomes, per se, but it's more to highlight what we need to be doing. So,
And I love the incidental health education while people are stuck in those lines. Are others of you involved with community efforts like this?
We're just going to be starting it. So
oh, great. Yeah, I'll give you my card and share best practices.
Any additional questions or comments? Anything that you guys didn't get to say that you're dying to add to your presentation?
I do have a question about the utilization rate that food pantries, in terms of where what percentage of the participants are seniors or adults? You may have said that.
I don't know if I mentioned about 10%.
Okay.
So in San Diego County, food banks serve about 480,000 people a month, and about 10%.
And are there any home delivery?
Yes, the one that I highlighted, the Angel Depot, does provide some home delivery, but that's very limited in terms of, I mean, San Diego's a big county, but that's.
I'd like to add maybe a couple of sentences. Just, I haven't had an opportunity to acknowledge my community collaborators for one reason, that they wanted to be silent in the presentation's publications. But it was actually a very rewarding collaboration. Even though we did all of the data collection through the community clinics, and there was one specific coordinator who did the data collection, the dedication of women who participated in the study to the study and to the issue was absolutely amazing, because they were making sure that a lot of community members were volunteering to the study. They participated in a focus group talking about how important it is to participate in research, and both from the point of view of vitamin D and any other nutritional outcome. So I just wanted to say thank you to them, even though silently or anonymously.
And what was the process about getting permission to work with the
tribal clinic? The particular tribal communities that we worked with, in this study, there was one community that participated. The clinic was asked to be the kind of a doorkeeper, so they reviewed our proposal. We talked and discussed with them. We met with women who also added certain specific components to the study, how they wanted it to happen on the reservation. And then the representative from the clinic went to the tribal government. They wanted me to answer any questions. There was a discussion and then approval. And then the clinic representatives were kind of liaisons between the researchers and the community members. So it was a long process.
Yes, it's hard. Yeah.
But it was a very rewarding one, because
right.
Then you when you really have a great collaboration and contribution. And this study is actually a third with this group, and every time after the conclusion of the study, I'm up on the reservation or in the community doing community talks and answering questions. And the usual question from the community is, so what are you doing next? You know, go out and write some grants. Let's do some more work.
Do they have a suggestion of indigenous kind of food that might be used to fortify vitamin D?
Well, we haven't really gotten to that level, but that's a good suggestion. I think next time we'll be doing a community talk, I will actually be asking that question.
So, Ruthie, just a question. What did you use for the basis for your nutrition advice when you were talking to these people in the lines and giving out this advice? What were your basic principles that you taught people?
Well, starting with accessibility and affordability of nutrition, that was kind of point one, and then focusing on the key areas that were also highlighted here on where seniors are most deficient and what are the most common preventable diseases for aging populations and what foods are therapeutic for those. And then
it sounded like you were pretty much emphasizing whole foods, mm-hmm. and trying to get them away from the highly processed foods and
absolutely. So that
eating more fresh fruits and veggies, I think, is in there, but it didn't necessarily tell people to not eat meat or dairy.
Thank you for clarifying your question. So what we focus on is what are the shelf-stable items that are the highest nutrient density and closest to the whole food form. So although produce is really important, a lot of seniors don't have access to it on a regular basis or can't cook with it regularly. So it was really what are the different bulk grains, legumes, and primarily non-meat sources of protein other than the cold water fish that are available.
So this was targeted at stocking the pantry through these food banks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
you're not going to be handing out like T-bone steaks or whatever.
Right. Because we're working so closely with the food banks and food pantries, it's really making what are the small modifications to the foods that are already being distributed. So moving away from, you know, the really high sodium, high fructose corn syrup, highly processed foods, and what are those, how can we, working with again the non-perishables, get those to be healthiest, and then teaching menu planning, grocery shopping, recipe building around those, and then where to supplement at the farmer's market.
How did you go about influencing the shift between, you know, kind of the junk non-perishables into the more healthy choices? I see that as there being barriers to do that.
Huge barriers, and actually I'm presenting tomorrow morning at 8:30 on nutrition banking and what that transformation process is, because we've created kind of one of the first models here, and we're working on a resource manual that any food bank or food pantry can then use to go through that transformation process, because there are a lot of challenges.
Right, well, I want to thank all of our five speakers. You guys did great job, and I want to thank the audience for being so attentive and listening, and keep up the good work. So thank you guys very much.